into our lives. Let us read them together. Hosea chapter 2, starting with verse 16. You thought I was done with this passage, but we actually never got to these verses. And there are five incredible promises about what we can anticipate in the millennial kingdom of Christ. Or if you don't want to believe in a millennium, in the heaven when it comes to earth and Christ reigns on earth. There are five things in this passage that Hosea lets the people of Israel know. God is going to do these things. And these are the things that we can expect in our future and in the future of Israel. But even more importantly than that, there are three high points in this passage where Hosea keeps coming back to the relationship that God has with his people. And in three different times, at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end, he comes back to that relationship and he brings out new things each time about what that relationship means for us. Let us read these holy words, these ancient words from Hosea chapter 2, verse 16 through 3, 1. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And then he returns to the relationship. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. And then he returns to the promises. And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord, I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel, and I will sow her for myself in the land. It's like he can't be too long away from talking about his bride. And he then returns again to the relationship. And I will have mercy on no mercy. And I will say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. Satan has a favorite television show on TV right now. Now, it's going to probably disappoint my wife what I think his favorite television show is. If I asked her, I'm going to guess she thinks his favorite television show is The Big Bang Theory. And she's got a point. Satan loves comedies that love to slip in all kinds of immoral behavior under laughter. He loves that. And so I suspect that I could make a top 10 list of Satan's favorite shows. He loves shows that glorify violence and hatred and anger. He loves those shows. But the show that I'm thinking of that is his favorite show is The Antique Roadshow. And the reason why I think it's Satan's favorite show is because it tells stories of people's lives, and he just revels in the story that it's telling. So last week we were watching Antique Roadshow. And those of you who have seen it, it has kind of a theme with every story. But we were watching a particular one of those stories where this man, who was a fairly old man, talked about his grandparents, who were not very wealthy at all, at some time ended up purchasing this blanket. And it was not a very impressive blanket, in all honesty. It was just stripes of wool of some sort. Now, the man there said, boy, if you could feel the blanket, you would know this is really a prized blanket. And we're just looking at it thinking, not even really that colorful, and it's just lines. And he starts talking about the blanket. The man knew that it was probably made by the Navajo. It was in Tucson. That's kind of why we were watching it. We saw the Antique Roadshow in Tucson, and of course, Ethan lives there, and that's all it takes for us to start watching a show. And He talked about that he's had this blanket his whole life, and it's thrown over one of his chairs in his living room, and it's hanging there. And the guy says, well, this is a special blanket. This is a very, very early Navajo blanket, before they started making their blankets with all the great designs, with the diamonds and all the different things in it. It's old because it doesn't have any of those things. It's just straight lines across. He said, we can also tell that you have an advantage with this blanket in that it has a tear in it. It had to be repaired. And we can tell just how old this blanket is because the person who repaired this is a Navajo Indian from the 1800s, mid to late 1800s. They could tell by the way it was repaired just how old the blanket was. And then he mentioned it's a special blanket because it was made for chiefs. And we know that this blanket was made for a Ute chief. He said, do you have any idea how much it's worth? I mean, how much do you think your grandparents paid for it? That's one of their favorite questions, right? How much did you pay for this? How much did it cost you to get this? Usually, it's some insignificant amount. And he said, that's when he told us, well, my grandparents weren't very wealthy, so they couldn't have paid that much for it. Do you have any idea how much it's worth? No, not at all. It's worth $300,000. See, we love that story, right? Satan loves that story too. In fact, it was one of those shows where that was 2002, and they said, what's it worth now? It's now worth $500,000. I hope the man didn't sell it, but I bet he did. I bet he sold it, and you know what? That great story, he's probably kicking himself right now because he lost $200,000 in the last 15 years, which is why Satan loves that show. Satan loves that show because, and I'm going to contrast this with God at the end of the sermon. Satan works under a principle. He loves getting something for nothing. Satan works under the principle, he loves getting something for nothing. So do we, don't we? See, this part of us, it's right in our human nature. We love getting something for nothing. Now, I want you to think about that show. That show is filled with stories of people who got something for nothing. But you know what that means? There is a story they are not telling. There is a story they're not telling. They're not telling the story of the person who sold something for nothing. And that's the part that Satan loves. Because behind every one of those stories we love is a tragic story of a person who had something. And maybe they desperately needed that something. Maybe that something could have kept them and sustained their family. But they were so desperate, they sold it for what? For nothing. Usually to a person who probably doesn't even need it, who then will sell it for something and have more than he ever needed. Because isn't that the nature of it? That's why we like garage sailing, right? I think that Satan would be a great garage sailor. He's always looking for a bargain. He's looking for a bargain. He's looking to find a treasure and find a way to pay almost nothing for it. This is why I thought of that particular illustration. It came from Derek Kidner's commentary on Hosea, and it came from Hosea 3:1, where we talked about last week that God loved Israel so much that he told Hosea, I want you to go out and take Gomer, even though she's now in an adulterous relationship with a man, another man who is loving her. I want you to go and I want you to bring her into your home and I want you to love her because of how much I love my people. Even though they love pastries, even though they love donuts, even though instead of returning my deep affectionate love towards them, instead of returning that love to me, they're chasing after other gods and they are loving pastries. In other words, they are selling their soul for nothing. They're selling their soul for nothing. And so consequently, Derek Kidner mentioned, I bet you Screwtape would really enjoy this. And he is referring to a character in a C.S. Lewis book called The Screwtape Letters. And Screwtape is a demon. He was kind of a head demon. And the point of the book, C.S. Lewis is showing a spiritual warfare. And Screwtape was this head demon, and he was in charge of training understudy demons. And so he's training this understudy demon on how to tempt and how to bring destruction upon God's people, because they're not really focused on people that don't know Jesus. They're not really focused on people who don't know God. They're already in the camp. They're not really interested in them. He's trying to get God's people to be destroyed. And so Screwtape is training this understudy, and he makes this comment to his understudy as he talks about how we tempt them, how we bring them to this destruction. He says this: an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure is the formula. That's the formula of human destruction at the hands of Satan. An ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. And then he says these words, which make, I think, Derek Kidner think of this chapter. And it's better style, it is more certain, to get the man's soul and give him nothing in return. That is what really gladdens our Father's heart. Of course, Father here is not our Father, but Satan. That's what gladdens Satan's heart, is to get something of real value and to get it for nothing. In fact, Mark chapter 8, verse 36 says, what profiteth a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul? Satan knows something. He knows that each one of us is worth more than the world. He knows our value in the eyes of God. He knows what our value should be to ourselves because of the value God gives us. And in fact, I think we could safely say that Satan would be willing to give us the world. He was willing to give Jesus the world, right? In one of his temptations. He would be willing to give us the world if we would just give him our soul. But remember these words: but he finds it far more satisfying to give us nothing for it. He'd be willing to give us the world for it, but he finds it far more satisfying to give nothing for it. Guys, that's kind of how we are, right? When people come to your house and they point out something that's really nice and you paid a lot of money for it, I have never once heard a person say, yeah, that's really great. I paid $5,000 for that. Now, maybe really rich people do that, I don't know, but I've never heard anyone say that. But I can't count how many times you come in and you, wow, that is a magnificent bookcase. Yeah, I got it for $10 at a garage sale. Why? Because we're proud of it. We're proud of the fact that we got something for nothing. We don't even think about the fact that, boy, that person, they gave me something really valuable for and did not know its value. They didn't know its value and they sold it for nothing. But Satan sees the backside of that story. I wanted to start there because that's where we ended last week. This week, though, I want you to see how God is different than that. God is not like that. In fact, he's very different. So different that, in all honesty, he's incomprehensibly different to us and certainly to Satan. So we come to these verses, and in that day, verse 16, and in that day, throughout the prophets, especially in Joel, especially in Amos, especially in Hosea, but really all of the prophets. But at this time, Isaiah was writing at the same time as well. Amos was writing about this time. When they talk about that day, they are talking about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord, the day of God's deliverance, the day when God will come back and rescue his people and sing his song of deliverance over them. They're talking about that day. Now, we know from the New Testament, we got to put some qualifiers here, that we realize that that day can be a long day. Because when Jesus came to this world the first time, that day began. That day started. And that's why in Acts chapter 2, Peter is standing there before a crowd. And this marvelous thing is going on, that the disciples, 120 disciples, are speaking the praises of God in various languages and dialects that these Jewish people from all over the world are hearing. And they're going, wow, how are they talking in our dialect? And what does Peter say? This is in fulfillment of Joel chapter 2 or 3. That day when God will pour out his spirit on people. So we know that actually that day is already here. But the culmination of that day has not already happened. That day lasts a long time. It's lasted 2,000 years. We call it the latter days now. And in fact, Hosea refers to it as the latter days twice in our passage, and in last week's passage. Two times he says latter days. So that day very quickly becomes latter days. And we are in those days right now, but there are some things about that day. They have not happened yet, and we are still waiting in anticipation and hope for them. And they're great things. But before we get to them, we have to first be introduced to what God is really interested in, his relationship with his people. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. In that day, you will not be ashamed of me. In that day, you'll not be running after some other lover. In that day, you'll not be giving yourself away to some false god. In that day, you will realize that I'm your husband, and I love you like no other husband can love you. Well, I would like to think that that part has already begun. That when Jesus came and his people began putting their faith in Jesus Christ, we started to realize that God, that Jesus is our husband, that he came and he wants a relationship with us. And he wants the kind of relationship that all other relationships not only take second fiddle, that we do not place anything above him, that we chase after nothing. And that's why he gives us this first promise, and he's still working on this one. He's still working on it, but a day will come when Jesus comes back a second time and it will be totally fulfilled, and it's number one. No longer will you call me my Baal, for I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. In other words, there is a day coming when there will be no gods in our life but God himself, God alone. Guys, that's a great day, because I don't think we really appreciate just how much harm we do to ourselves, how dishonoring it is to Yahweh that we entertain gods in our life. But a day is coming when we will not even remember the names of our gods. So I can throw some of my gods out there. The day is coming when somebody will say to me, you know, hey, did you catch that basketball game? And I will say, what's basketball? Basketball. Does anybody remember basketball or football? Do you remember those? See, I'm a Michigan guy. Do you remember those six Super Bowl championships of Tom Brady? I just got a couple. Who's Tom Brady? Now, we may know who Tom Brady is if he makes it to heaven. If God is, if he is one of the elect, we'll remember Tom Brady. I didn't know Tom Brady played football. I thought he was just a child of God. And by the way, what's football? What is that? This is what God is promising to Israel. You've been running after these gods, the Baals, the Ashtaroths, the Molechs. You've been running after them. I'm going to make you completely forget them. And every other god you have in your life, every other thing that you put before me, you're going to forget all about them. What a great promise that is. And he's doing it right now. He's working that promise right now, even as he was with Israel. Remember, Baal is a god of Canaan. Ashtaroth was a god of the Canaanites. The thing about those ancient worlds is that their gods were attached to lands. So Baal was a god who could function really well within the land of Canaan. But outside of the land of Canaan, according to their thinking, Baal couldn't function. Baal was not that impressive. Baal was not much of a god outside of his land. Now, if you kept him inside the land, Baal could do a lot for you in their thinking. But if you were not in the land of Canaan, Baal can't do much for you. This is what set Yahweh apart from all other gods. Because Yahweh was not attached to a particular land. Yahweh is the creator of the universe. He's the creator of the earth, the whole earth, and all the nations. He's the one and only God. And his power does not diminish when he crosses the Jordan River or goes north over the Golan Heights. But Baal's did. And God knew that that's what they believed. You know, so this is what he did. He said, I can solve this problem. You guys like Baal? Good. I'll move you 1,200 miles away. I'll move you to Babylon and to Assyria. Let's see if you worship Baal there. And I'll leave you there so long that you will forget who Baal and Ashtaroth are. Because you see, when Israel was taken into captivity to Babylon, they wouldn't have continued to worship Baal. Why? Because Baal has no power in Babylon. There's nothing Baal can do for him there. So they would have stopped worshiping him. So now they got a choice. And he was betting. They could either choose to worship then the gods of the Babylonians, or the gods of the Egyptians, or the gods of the Assyrians, or they could choose to return to him. Now, the truth is, I think we know even from Daniel, that many Jews, unfortunately, did choose to worship the gods of the Babylonians, at least for a while. But many of them, they forgot about those gods that they had been worshiping. But they remembered Yahweh. And in fact, when God brings them back to the promised land in the days of Nehemiah and Ezra, do you know that from that point on all the way to the time of Jesus, now I'm not saying they didn't have gods in their life, they absolutely did, but none of them were named Baal or Asherah. They never again worshiped the Baals and the Asherahs. They never again worshiped the Canaanite gods. You know why? Because they had forgot them. Now the problem was they had other gods that they were worshiping. And this is a promise, though, that says, for my people, the people who are my bride, I'm going to make them forget about every other man. They're going to forget about every other man except for me. Except for me. It makes me think of one of my favorite lines in a movie. It's in The Big Fish. And this man who tells these incredible stories that his son doesn't believe. And his son is sort of, he's a newspaper guy and he's investigating his father's life because he's absolutely convinced that his father had a second life where he had a second family and was having an affair on his mom. And so he goes and starts searching in his history. And as he searches in his history, these wild tales that his father told, he starts to realize had quite a bit of truth in those wild tales. But my favorite line in the movie is he comes to this woman that he is convinced is having an affair with his father. And she draws it out of him that that's why he was there. And she says to him, "Let me tell you about your father. There are only two women in this world, your mother and everyone else." Your mother and everyone. This is God. There's a day coming when I'm your husband. There are only going to be two men in this world, your husband and everybody else. There's no one there that can compete against me. There will be no one that in any way you will place before me. I will make you forget about every other man until you only have thoughts for me. I will make you forget about every other god until you only have thoughts for me. You will call me my husband. Isn't that great? It's not that he says here, I will call you my bride. That would make his point. You say, well, that's the same thing. No, it doesn't make his point. His point is, we will call him my husband. He's my husband. He's my God. He's the one that loves me and whom I love. And then he says in verse 17, or verse 18, the second thing, and I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heaven, and the creeping things of the ground. What does he mean by that? Well, fortunately, Hosea and Isaiah wrote at the same time. So if you go to Isaiah, we can get some pretty good ideas what he means by that, right? On that day, the lion will lie down with the lamb. On that day, the wolf, he's not going to eat the sheep. The little child, got to get creeping things in here, the little child will put his hand in a viper's nest, right? And it will not harm him. What is Isaiah talking about? In this kingdom that we are awaiting still, the culmination of Christ's coming at the second coming and establishing his kingdom, what will the world be like? Well, what it will be like is as in the days of the Garden of Eden. The animal kingdom, the creepy things, the insects. I cannot wait. We were hiking yesterday, being attacked by mosquitoes. But in that day, I will say, leave me alone, and they will obey me. Because we will have authority over that kingdom. And so consequently, do you know why the lion lays down with the lamb? I think you're probably thinking because God's trying to remove all death from the world. Maybe, but I don't think that's the point there. You might be thinking that, well, for that to happen, you know, there's going to be another evolutionary shift because we're going to have to make all lions into vegetarians. That's not the point of the verse. fact, sometimes we make our metaphors not just walk on all fours, but run on all fours. That's not the point of the metaphor. You know what the point of the metaphor is? The lion will lay down with the lamb because the shepherd tells it to. That's its only point. Its only point is that the shepherd will have authority over the animal kingdom. And the shepherd is caring for his sheep. The lion is a threat to his sheep. No problem. You will no longer be a threat to my sheep. You will lie down with that lamb. And that lion is under the authority of the shepherd. That's the point of the analogy, the metaphor, that a day is coming when things will be restored. And he's not only going to make us forget about all those other gods, he's going to restore the authority that he created man with, Adam and Eve with, human beings with. And when that authority is in place and we are acting righteously and justly, well, things are going to get really good. You're not going to be worried about the threatening things that can be out there in the animal kingdom, because nothing will threaten you, which is why he immediately moves into another thing that threatens us. See, in their world, those animals, lions, wolves, these things, they were a threat to people. But there was a much bigger threat than those animals, right? What was the biggest threat to these people? Other people, right? Other people are the biggest threat, which is why Hosea then gives us the third one. I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. Well, that has not been accomplished. And unfortunately, I'm not even seeing progress. But then Jesus told us there wouldn't be a whole lot of progress on this front, would they? He says, guys, there will be wars and rumors of wars right to the end. There's not going to be a lot of progress in this front. But when Christ comes back and at the Battle of Armageddon, this is going to be put an end to. No more wars. No more conflicts, no more weapons. We won't need them. And I will make you lie down in safety. Wow. Do you start to get the picture? We'll have no gods in our lives that are more attractive to us than Yahweh himself. He will be my husband. We will be at peace and in a covenantal relationship with the animal kingdom. Nothing will be a threat to us from there. He will abolish the conflict that we have with one another. All the things that are going on right now in our country, they will not be going on when Jesus comes back. None of that violence, none of that hatred, none of that division. Isn't that a great promise? Okay, sometimes we need to just pause and think about what God has promised his people. And then verse 19, right back to where he started. And I will betroth you to me forever. The first is, you will call me your husband. Now he's saying, and I will call you my bride. And I will call you my bride. I will betroth you to me forever. And I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. And I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Now, I did not see it here. But I read four commentaries on Hosea, and you rarely get four commentaries to agree on anything. And they all said the same thing, and I wasn't exactly sure why they were saying it. But all of them were referring to the Hebrew, and I used to know Hebrew, and I can pretend like I know Hebrew. I can fake it with anyone who doesn't know Hebrew. You would think I knew Hebrew, but if you knew Hebrew, you'd know I don't know Hebrew anymore. But they were talking about the Hebrew of this passage. And they all made the same point. That what this is talking about here is not so much that God shows his righteousness to his bride, that God shows his justice in relationship to his bride, that God shows his steadfast love to his bride. That makes perfect sense, and they would say that Hosea certainly, as a book, talks about those things. But their point was is that, no, here Hosea is talking about a bride price. That the little word it's using to connect it is the word you would use to connect the bride price with the betrothal. That God has come to pay, like any groom would, a betrothal price. When Joseph was betrothed to Mary, he entered into a contract with Mary's father. And in that part of the contract, it's Joseph who has to kick out something, right? It's Joseph who has to pay. Now later on, during the wedding, the end of the contract, it's the father who has to pay something, the dowry. We call it a dowry. What I think is interesting, and I think is why God might have chosen a wedding to depict his salvation, is there's an awful lot of pain going on here, and nothing's being paid by the bride. The bride doesn't have to pay anything. The father has to pay something. The groom has to pay something. But the bride doesn't have to pay anything. What a perfect thing to use if you want to talk about salvation. Because God's people don't have to pay anything. But the groom does. He pays his whole life. The father does. He spared not his own son. People are paying for what we're not paying for. We're getting what? Something for nothing. Because we're not paying anything. Now, it isn't nothing for somebody. In fact, you might say from the other side, they're getting nothing. A bunch of broken down sinners. Not just for something, for everything. It's costing them everything. But that's how God works. He doesn't work like Satan works. And so these are the bride prices. So what we should be reading here is, I will betroth you by giving you my righteousness, or with righteousness. But with righteousness meaning, because I'm going to betroth you by giving you my righteousness, by giving you my justice, by giving you my steadfast love, by giving you my mercy, by giving you my faithfulness. That's why all of these writers connected this verse to the new covenant in Jeremiah 31. Because they basically said, that's been the problem all along here, even in Hosea. What's the problem with Gomer? Is Hosea faithful? He's a faithful man. Has Hosea acted righteously in relationship to Gomer? He's acted righteously. What's the problem in the relationship? Gomer isn't faithful. Gomer isn't righteous. You know, Gomer doesn't have mercy. Gomer doesn't have justice. That's the problem. The problem's on that side. And so their point is that the way God is going to solve this is with a new covenant. And in the new covenant, he's going to write his law on our hearts so that we have his righteousness. In fact, you might argue this is one of the earliest passages that allude to a doctrine we call imputation. The imputation of righteousness. That God will impute his righteousness upon his wife. He will impute his own faithfulness upon his wife so that that covenant will never be broken. It's a great promise. The day is coming when we will never, ever again be unfaithful to God. The day is coming when we see Jesus. When you see him, you will be made like him. The day is coming when the righteousness of God is all that we had. My brother and I were talking yesterday about the judgment. We were talking about a guy that was mentioning from Romans 2 that Christians are going to face judgment. And I said, well, it doesn't even matter to me. Because all these people are saying there is a judgment. When is the judgment? The judgment is when Christ comes back. I'm okay to face judgment when Christ comes back. Because when I see him, I will be made like him. So the Tom Wood that stands before the judge of all the universe will have already been conformed into the image of Jesus Christ. I can face judgment in that condition. I just don't want to face judgment now. When I have yet been conformed. But if the judgment comes after Christ's return, I'm all right with that. That doesn't scare me any. I'm not shaking in my boots about that because I will be made like him. I will have the righteousness of Christ fully and completely. And this is the promise that God is making through Hosea to his people. I'm going to make a new covenant with you and I'm going to give you my righteousness, my faithfulness, my mercy, my justice, my steadfast love, so that you can return it to me this time. Return that to me, be faithful to me, have steadfast love for me, and not love donuts. I'm giving you my steadfast love so that you can love me, not so you can chase after gods and love raisin cakes. And you will, because I'm also going to give you my faithfulness. Now, a few weeks ago, I want to talk about two of these just to give you an illustration from the New Testament why they work. A few weeks ago, Amelia came to me and asked me a question about this parable in the New Testament. It's the parable of a king who has a son who's getting married, so it kind of fits this, right? And he sends out an invitation to his friends and the people he thought were his friends, important people, because he was an important man. And they all came back with excuses why they couldn't come to the wedding banquet. Well, he's not happy. He is not happy. So he tells his servants, I want you to go out to the highways and byways and invite all of the homeless people, because that's who lives on highways and byways, right? It's homeless people and travelers, strangers in the land. So let's just put them in a modern context. He went out and invited all the homeless people and the illegal immigrants to come to his wedding. Now, he also sent some into the city and said, you know, invite all the people in the corners. And so those are sort of the common people that live in the city. They all came, and the whole place was filled, and everything's great, and Amelia had no problems at all. Until that little part in that parable that says what? There was a man there who did not have the wedding garment. And the king comes in, the owner, the master comes in and sees the man is not dressed in the wedding garment. And he says to his servants, what? Take that man and throw him outside where there is darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth. Well, that seems a little harsh. I mean, first you go out and you invite a bunch of homeless people in and they're not dressed appropriately enough. And so you throw them out. That doesn't even make sense in a modern context, does it? So she asked me about this. I don't really get that. And I said, well, there's one little thing in that story that we don't know that everyone hearing that story in the first century would have known. That any time a person, especially a king, had a wedding banquet and invited people, he provided the clothing for them. When they came to the banquet, they were provided with the wedding clothes to wear. So if there was a person in that banquet that was not wearing the wedding clothes, he was not wearing it because he refused it. He refused the clothes that the king had provided for him. And this was Jesus' very point in the parable. There is going to be a wedding banquet, and God the Father provides the clothes. They are the robes of righteousness. They are the robes of Jesus' righteousness. They are right here. I will give you my righteousness. And if you think you can come to that wedding banquet, but you have no interest in wearing God's righteousness, you have no interest in your life being conformed into the righteousness of God, well, guess what? There's no place for you in that wedding banquet. And you will be cast out. Because the only people that can be a part of that wedding banquet, the only people that can be a part of these promises and these kingdoms, this kingdom of God, is people that want the righteousness of God. And they are thrilled to death when the owner of the banquet comes and says, here's my robe. I want you to wear my robe of righteousness. They wouldn't dream of not wearing it. They live for wearing that robe. They long for it. They are so tired of their dirty attire, their filthy rags. They see that robe of righteousness and that's all they want. And this is what Hosea is saying. And I will betroth you forever. I'll give you my righteousness and my justice. And we could talk about each one of these, my steadfast love. But I just want to talk about my mercy. God is going to give us his mercy. I think this is the explanation to why Jesus will say a couple of times, if you cannot forgive the person who has offended you, then you are not forgiven. That seems pretty harsh, doesn't it? It seems pretty harsh that God's going to say, if we can't forgive somebody who's wronged us, he's not going to forgive us. But there is a context in which that makes perfect sense. If God, when he forgave us, and he made us his child, he adopted us as his child, if God not only imputes his righteousness, but an aspect of that righteousness is his mercy. God gives us his mercy. So that we then can take the very mercy that we've experienced from him and show it to other people. If we go around and we will not show mercy to other people, you know what that is? That's being at a wedding banquet without the wedding garment. You're at a wedding banquet and you've refused to wear the wedding garment. That's why Jesus says, if you don't forgive this person, you will not be forgiven. But God is not asking us to forgive that person in our own power. He knows we're completely incapable of forgiving the people that have harmed us. We want vengeance. We want justice. We don't want mercy for that person. He knows that, but that's why he gives us his mercy. He shows us his mercy. He shows us what mercy looks like. And he said, now I'm going to give you, through my spirit, I'm going to give you my mercy to give to other people. So that ultimately, if we are part of the kingdom of God and we are part of God's children, we are going to give mercy. Verse 21, we get another promise, the fourth one. And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord, and I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. And the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, and the oil. And they shall answer Jezreel. He's already talked about this, but one of the promises is that when this day comes, I am going to make the land so productive. You will never have to worry about where food comes from or where anything that you might need comes from. Now, by the time you get to the millennial kingdom and we are in resurrected bodies, I'm not sure food is all that important to us. But I think the imagery is what he's shooting for. Everything that we need, everything that God desires for his children will be provided for us, because God will speak and the heavens will answer. The heavens will speak and the earth will answer. The earth will speak and wine, oil, grain will answer. Basically, it's a picture that everything will be right in the world. No famine, no drought, no weeds, no parched land. Everything will be working as God had intended it, and his people will be fully provided for. That is the vision he gives. And he gives one more thing, number 5, and I will sow her for myself in the land. We can't miss this. And I will put Israel back in the land, in her land. Now, I could go off and make all kinds of comments about Israel being back in the land. God is talking about his people, people who are have put their faith in him. Now, I do believe that there are ethnic Israelites at the core of those people, and I do believe that they will be put back in the land. But ultimately, the one who was put there, the one who acquires, is Jesus himself. He is the heir of Abraham. He, all, not just Palestine, but the whole world belongs to him. But there is one last promise: I will plant her in the land. I think of it more as God is promising his people, I will plant you right back where you started, in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden. To which then he comes back to his same theme. And I will have mercy. I will have love. I will have Ruhama on Lo Ruhama. And I will say to Lo Ami, not my people, I will say, you are Ami. He changes his name. And he shall say, Ami shall say, you are my God. Let me close with this illustration, a story. I don't have my kids around to tell stories too much anymore. I love making up stories. I want to make up a story that I think illustrates what God is doing and how he operates different than Satan. A long time ago, in this very galaxy, and not very far away from here, there was a king. And this king had all kinds of things at his fingertips, all kinds of wealth, all kinds of everything. He was a powerful, powerful king. And one day he decided that he wanted to reflect his glory. And so he personally made a cloak for himself that would reflect his glory. And so he went throughout his kingdom and he found the finest of all things. But even as fine as they were, it was his craftsmanship that made them priceless. And so on this cloak, he had all kinds of things, the threads that it was made of, just the materials, the colors, and different things that decorated this cloak, from gems to pearls to buttons. Everything on the cloak was perfect because he had crafted each one and he was a master craftsman. And that cloak reflected his beauty and his glory. And he entrusted that cloak to a servant of his. He said, I want you to be the guardian cherub of my cloak. Now, every analogy falls apart because in this analogy, the cloak doesn't have free will. And the cloak does not participate in what happened to it. But in the true reality of the story, it points to people who do have free will, who do make choices, and who do participate in what happened to it. But in my story, it's just going to be put on the guardian cherub. So the guardian cherub had the cloak, and he knew that the king loved it. He knew he loved it more than anything, and he hated the fact that the king loved it. In fact, he thought, maybe the king loves it more than it loves me, but that wasn't true. But he lied to himself. In fact, it may have been the first lie. He lied to himself and said that he must love that coat more than me. Look what he's done for it. So he took that coat and he dismantled it. And he ripped it to pieces. And he spread every item of that cloak out over all of the kingdom. And it was destroyed. And the items of that cloak became deteriorated with time. And they were just shraps of threads and cloth, and colorful things had faded. The buttons had been, who were so bright and shiny and gold and silver, and had just become broken and looked like nothing. And one day the king said, I'm going to restore my cloak. And so he went out into his kingdom and he sought every part of that cloak. And he brought it. And with his great masterful hands, he restored each part and put it together until the whole cloak was restored, except for one button. There was still a button missing off his cloak. And he searched high and low for that button until he found it in a garage sale. And there in a garage sale was a broken, beaten up button that was worth nothing. In fact, people had been looking, you don't know this person, but Jim Carroll had looked at that button because he likes to collect buttons and he's an antique collector. He said, that's not worth a thing, and cast it aside. And people had looked at that button and it only had the price of a nickel on it and nobody wanted it. And one day the king showed up at that garage sale and saw the button and knew it. That's the button that belonged to his coat. And he said, how much do you want for it? And the person said, well, I had a nickel on it, but you know what? I couldn't get anybody to give me a nickel, so you know what? You can have it for nothing. And the king said, I'll give you everything I have for it. I'll give you everything I have for it. And the person said, I don't understand. Why would you give me everything I have for it? Everything you have for it. He says, I know I could get it for nothing, but it's far more satisfying if I can give you everything for it. There is an answer to that man's question. It starts in Isaiah. I'll give you three passages and in Isaiah 55, God's ways are not our ways. And they're not Satan's either. In fact, they're usually the opposite, and we can't fathom it. And then I go to Romans chapter 8, and he says, he spared not his son. He was willing to give everything for us. But I want to conclude by reading Ephesians chapter 3, because here he tells us why he is more interested in paying everything for something that's worth nothing. Why he would rather pay everything for something that's worth at least nothing to some people. He tells us in Ephesians 3. He tells us in Ephesians 3, and I leave us with this, and then I'll just read the doxology and we'll sing a song, because there's a doxology right after this. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, verse 14, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with power throughout his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend. I did this so that you can understand something. I paid everything for you when you were worth nothing, so you could understand something, you could comprehend something with all the saints that I've done this for. And what is it that he wants us to comprehend? The breadth and the length and the height and the depth, and to know the love of Christ. I want you to know how much I love this button. I want everybody to know how much I love this button. This button isn't worth a nickel. It's not worth nothing. It's worth everything. And I want the whole world to know how much that button is worth and what I'm going to make it worth when I restore it and put it in my cloak. And he wants the whole world to know what you're worth. He wants you to know the height and the depth and the breadth of his love for you, That's why he paid everything for you. Do you know God could have created a system where it didn't cost that much to redeem us? He's God. He could do whatever he wanted. When he created the world, he could have made a system where he didn't have to pay a great price to redeem his people. But he created a system where he had to pay everything. Why? Because he wanted them to know how much he loved them. And that's why he says here, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. You can't even comprehend this kind of love. That you may be filled with the fullness of God. Because until you grasp the depth and height and breadth of God's love, you will not actually be able to know the fullness of who God is. It's why the angels were peeking. Because they had never seen the depth of love as he showed on the cross. They were peeking because they wanted to see it. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we have or ask or think, according to the power at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. Let's stand and sing.